Kia ora. Good evening. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I just wanted to clarify my political stance. I'm sort of a little bit left to the right and a bit of right to the left and not quite the center in the scheme of things. I'm going to try and frame my discussion more so on principles, because religion, particularly Islam, from my perspective, really provides principles rather than manuals as to how to run things. Islam particularly leaves human beings to interpret and make things run. So let's talk about some principles from an Islamic perspective. And before I do that, I wanted to quote from Joseph Schumpeter's The History of Economic Analysis to frame something which I might contend, may slightly disagree with what Chris was mentioning about the New Zealand's heritage in Christian, Judeo-Christian heritage. Joseph said, so far as our subject is concerned, in particularly economics here, we may safely leap over 500 years to the epoch of St. Thomas Aquinas, whose Summa Theologica in the History of Thought was that the southwestern spire of the Cathedral of Chartres is in the history of architecture. What he was trying to do was fill this gap, what was called the Dark Ages of Europe, literally missing that when there was Dark Age of Europe, assuming that in fact nothing noteworthy was written in this period of time, that in fact there was a very high level of activity happening in the golden years of Islam. And this cannot be forgotten, because when we speak of the Judeo-Christian ideas in our economics, particularly in the context of today's discussion, Islam has a lot to offer and has already offered, particularly through the six major Muslim scholars which I wanted to mention: Abu Yusuf, Ibn Sina, Al-Ghazali, Averroes, Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn al-Qayyim, and Ibn Khaldun, who is considered to be the father of the socio-political discussions, particularly in economics, which has a lot to do with what was written later, particularly when we talk about the Keynesian theories and Adam Smith's writings as well, who both, in fact, acknowledge particularly peoples like Ibn al-Ghazali and Ibn Khaldun. The point for me to raise this is not to in any way be contentious of the issue, but more to make a point that Islam's juridical and social sciences extensively discuss the concept, structure, and aspirations of an economic system. And what I want to do here is to look at one of those scholars who literally sums up the economic structures that Islam proposes, and someone who spoke a lot about what we would speak about price mechanisms and the market forces was Imam al-Ghazali himself, from whose name we actually have named our center after. I want to also quickly mention the Arabic word for economy, which is al-iqtisadiyya. And al-iqtisad is an interesting word because it refers to something that someone seeks to pursue, particularly adopting a very frugal, very least taxing, most economical middle path. And this definition of what Islam sees as economy is a very important point when we start to talk about how the mechanisms of the market, in fact, work. It's quite interesting also that the word also shares the same root word to refer to structured poetry. So hopefully there's some orchestra that actually can work through economy and music in that regard. Islam's foundations are built on two things. The first is what is referred to as Tawheed, the oneness of God, and something which is not going to be of much of contextual discussion here today, it's the second one, which is Jalb al-Masalih, and literally means the accrual of benefit, what we would speak of overall well-being of the human society. Then in fact this is the second pillar, the second foundation of Islam, such that when there is economy occurring, if there is an economic activity, that it's the environment that needs to be taken into account. When I speak of the environment, I'm not speaking about the biodiversity and the natural environment, but in fact four. Firstly, the natural environment. Secondly, the economic environment. Thirdly, the social environment. And fourthly, something that is missing in today's politics, and that is spiritual environment. This idea of maslaha, the accrual of benefits, is an extremely powerful concept. In fact, one of the commentators of economics of the modern world, Mr. Zarqa, he argued that based on al-Ghazali's writings, we can discover the hard-to-pin-down utility of a social welfare function that modern economists long for. And this idea of social welfare is, without a doubt, an important question when we speak of economy, and we'll speak a little bit more about that, and hopefully in the discussions we can take it further. As such, Islam's interest in positive social welfare is ultimately to protect five sacred rights for a human being overall. Number one, the right to protect life. Number two, the right to practice religion. Number three, the right to access knowledge. Number four, the right to familial access and lineage. And number five, the right to private material ownership. Positive social development is essentially the key objective of the Islamic Sharia. And the economic framework of any time and place would merely be a means by which to achieve it. In other words, the economy is not an end in itself. It's not an automaton, but a means to human development under a careful custodial management of the human agency. Islam says, and I would assume that both Christianity and Judaism would agree, that God is, in fact, the ultimate and real owner, and humans are custodial directors of the divine. And in fact, unlike the company directors, the human directors are fully responsible for their actions. Such an economic framework would function on a three-level hierarchy, which are, number one, referred to as daruriyat, which is the economy of necessities, and which is the primary focus of the state to administer, manage, and legislate. At this level, Islam's significant pillar of charity and sincere concern for the other is invoked. The second level, called manfa'a, is the economy of comforts and refinements, and which is essentially controlled via a supply and demand market forces and highly geared towards a user policy, user pays policy. So, as Jared Diamond calculated, that if you were to buy an iPad today on a user pays basis, taking into account of the four environments I spoke about, the iPad would probably cost $5,000. So this idea that somehow it's the citizens who are mostly subsidized is a whole lot of what I would call hullabaloo, because the highest subsidized entity in today's Western world is the corporation. The third level is what is referred to as zenat, which is the economy of frivolous luxuries, and which is on the one hand rejected in Islam, but its primary framework is one driven by a spiritual conscience rather than through regulation based on what we would call moral capitalism. Under the first economic policy level, the state functions as an agent of benevolence through its more affluent citizens, either via voluntary charity or prescribed charity. And modern-day feminist economics and the frameworks of that would actually prioritize, for example, avoidable poverty, welfare, particularly the protection of women and children, are very explicit policies in the principle of Islam at this first level. Under the second economy policy level, it is the market that principally defines and drives activity. Most importantly, state governance play a significant role in auditing environmental and social degradation, and Islam very clearly holds that economy has an impact on social degradation and that needs to be managed and not left to be running wild. That economy activity may cause, and such would respond accordingly to curb such negative impact. One of the other points which I want to just moot here, something which was in the newspapers a couple of days ago in Australia, this movement from private capitalism to the successful, hopefully, in one way or the other, state capitalism seen in China and the Gulf areas. I'll leave it there, and hopefully we can discuss a little bit more about a discussion on private and state capitalism. Under the third economic policy level, theology is fully propagated in order to impress upon people's conscience against the frivolity at the expense of others. As such, a moral call is invoked. A critical reminder is made that ultimately the material is only a means and not the ends to itself. The means is to attain success not in this world, but the hereafter that awaits. It calls upon the proposition to consider higher objectives, that an obsession with the material will be the downfall of the human society, and contrary to what the material was created for in the first place. And this moral capitalism opposes the ideas of the following: maximization of profits at the expense of the labor force and the environment that creates the wealth for the entrepreneur in the first place. It opposes hoarding of natural resources, particularly with the help of coercive powers of the state, away from the hands of legitimate owners of land in which the resources exist. If it had not been for religious moral values, we would have a soulless political economy today. Extracting natural resources from public lands for corporate profits at the exclusion of the citizen stakeholders, and material consumerism that fuels the above at the expense of the environment that sustains the present and the future generation. And this last point is that, in fact, ultimately the responsibility lies with the individual citizen, that if they were going to be material consumers, then they would drive those who would be driven by greed and self-serving values to be affected in the manner that we have been. Finally, the pillar of an economic system proposed by Islam is that wealth is created in real time out of real things. The antithesis to this idea is the concept of interest rates as a means of profiteering on monetary capital. The idea of free market propped by debt financing and futures is a recipe for disaster, which is being experienced today in places like Greece and definitely rejected by Islam. And ultimately, Islam sees the economy as a vehicle for equity and justice for its citizens and preservation of peace through it, so that the human development on this earth at personal and collective levels is possible. Only then can the human being prepare to meet his or her Lord afterwards. I want to end by a quick little joke, if I could, which sort of sums up with our situation with the economy today and probably tells us that we need to actually look at alternatives. Hopefully I can remember the joke properly. The joke is that gentleman comes over to a hotel and he puts a deposit of $100 on the table and goes and inspects the rooms while he leaves the money there. The proprietor of the hotel takes this money and goes running to the grocer to pay his account to him. And the grocer then runs over to the mechanic and pay for his account there for fixing up his truck. And the truck mechanic pays it to the butcher for supplying his meat as an account. And the butcher runs back to the hotel to pay the hotelier for having stayed overnight to actually supply his goods. At that moment of time, the guest comes over, picks the $100 up and declares that he doesn't like the hotel and he's going to go. But that's okay. Everybody's happy because everybody's debt-free. Thank you very much.